Back together again, you and I, Wednesday, January 11th, 2023 on Connecticut Today. We feature Jordan Davidson from the group Smart Approaches to Marijuana, talking about Connecticut's recreational marijuana rollout and who really stands to benefit the most. Former Florida GOP Congressman Francis Rooney talking about what's ahead for the new Congress. Francis Rooney, also a former ambassador to the Holy See in the Vatican. State Senate GOP head Kevin Kelly joining us to talk about state spending priorities in the near future. Quinnipiac University professor Sheila Hare detailing the observance of National Human Trafficking Awareness Day. And I also had some thoughts on the controversy surrounding newly elected GOP Congressman George Santos.
As we are now on day two on this January 11, 2023 of legal marijuana sales in the state, on the run-up to the legalization bill getting passed, we had folks on from an organization called SAM, S-A-M. The acronym is Smart Approaches to Marijuana. And they kind of watch the marijuana business, the industry, the interaction with governments. Who's really behind all this, although they do not take an exact position on legalization or not. And joining us right now is one of Sam's staffers to tell you about. He's currently a junior studying political science at American University in D.C., a Connecticut guy for years. When he was 17 years old, he entered long-term addiction recovery after struggling with cannabis use disorder, throughout his teen years. Jordan Davidson is now the Communications and Legislative Affairs Officer for SAM. Jordan, hi, it's Paul here, WICC in Bridgeport. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, Paul?
Great. And your story, before we get into what has happened here in Connecticut, which you lived for years, you tell me, here. Yep. Before we get into that, what about and what has happened over the past few days here, what's happening, you know, around the country? Give us a little background of your story, if you can, and explain a term that has been in the news. I remember doing shows about it, cannabis use disorder. What's that all about?
Yeah. So basically, just quickly here is when I was 17 years old, I entered in recovery from a cannabis disorder. And cannabis use disorder is this fancy term for a marijuana addiction. Actually, about one in three people today who use marijuana will grow an addiction to it. And that's because the products that I was using and that is being sold in Connecticut markets yesterday are potency THC. THC is what gets you high. It's the component that gets you high. In the 70s, THC had a potency of about 2-3%. These days, they're selling products regularly that have upwards of 99%. And so the kinds of things I was using multiple times a day, withdrawing from my friends and family and academics. And it got to a point where it was out of control and I couldn't control use whatsoever. And I reached out and asked for help and got sober in Connecticut. And I'm lucky to say that I have a little bit over 4 years of sobriety now.
Well, congratulations to you. One-time Connecticut resident Jordan Davidson is with us. He's currently the Communications and Legislative Affairs Officer for a group calling itself Smart Approaches to Marijuana. And Jordan, continuing with you, I remember talking to your compadres there a couple, three times over the past couple of years when this whole legal marijuana thing was ramping up in Hartford. Am I still correct to say, I remember correctly, that your group doesn't really take a position on use or non-use or legalization or non-legalization, but I know you do look at trends, right? And who's actually making money on this stuff and where are the political forces here, correct?
So we actually do take a position. We are against marijuana legalization, okay. But we're for kind of the low-level decriminalization possession.
Mm-hmm.
But we do certainly look at that. And a big reason that we're against legalization is because of those trends and looking who's really behind this and also the public health and safety outcomes that we've seen in legal states.
So what is changing now, Jordan? I remember talking to folks from your organization a couple of years ago, maybe last year or two, and there was a worry that this was going to morph from local growers and local retailers to like another big tobacco situation here where those big companies were already circling the corpse, if you will. Has that changed? What's up with that?
Unfortunately, not at all. And actually, it's already happening in Connecticut, Paul. So as you may know, 7 dispensaries opened yesterday for business for the first day of recreational sales in Connecticut. One of those dispensaries is actually owned by a company called Acreage Holdings, and it's one of the biggest marijuana kind of corporates in the world. And just to list off here for you, the members of the board of directors, including former Speaker of the House John Boehner, former Governor of Massachusetts Bill Weld, former CFO of IBM, former Prime Minister of Canada Brian Mulroney. The list goes on.
Not exactly a bunch of liberals there too, by the way.
No, exactly. So this is the thing that if your viewers could kind of understand here. Number one, this is all about big corporate profits. These guys are in it to make money. John Boehner stands to make $27 million. If marijuana is, that's his payout. If it's legally, made legal nationwide. And secondly, the small businesses are going to be pushed out by these groups that all they want to do is make profit. You're exactly right. It's not just liberals or Democrats. It's Republicans and conservatives too, because there are some people on both sides of the aisle who really just want the money, who want the profits, and those are the people in this industry.
So there may be people listening to us right now, Jordan Davidson, saying, hey, whatever, this is the American way. I mean, Apple started in, somebody's garage, and Microsoft was that way too. And yeah, okay, but they're selling a product that people want, and most people don't care who's cashing the checks as long as I can get my product. What would be your response to that?
Well, my response to that would be kind of two things. Number one, my question would be, ask yourselves right now, do you trust big tobacco? Watch out for health and safety. I'd reckon that most people would say no. When Canada legalized marijuana nationwide in 2018, on day one, Altria, the parent company of Marlboro and Philip Morris, invested $2 billion in that industry. These are the people, the former CEO of Purdue Pharma has created his own marijuana company. So that's one thing. The people behind this are not trustworthy whatsoever. The second thing is really negative public health outcomes that we're seeing. In addition to an estimated 7,000 driving deaths if marijuana becomes legal in every state, there's data coming out. This is actually, Paul, just from the last month. In a five-year period, we've seen an increase of 1,375% in kids aged 6 to 18 ingesting edible marijuana. We've seen since 2000, this is data just coming out past month, that marijuana abuse among adolescents has increased 245%, while alcohol use has decreased over that same period. And so we're seeing legalization is leading to these negative health outcomes for young people, and we don't want to spread that.
So is this a scenario, Jordan Davidson, and Jordan, by the way, is Communications and Legislative Affairs Officer for the group Smart Approaches to Marijuana. Is this a case of, for example, you mentioned Altria, one of the big tobacco companies, and there are numerous companies getting into this. Is this a case, Jordan, of just them saying, hey, you know what, our tobacco business is going to shrink probably, our vaping businesses are under attack, so this is the next big thing, we might as well get a foothold on this or a toehold because somebody's going to be doing it?
Yeah, well, what their mindset really is they're using the big tobacco playbook that was used to basically hoodwink the American public and trick them into thinking that these products were great and even healthy for you. And we're seeing the same thing with marijuana. They're seeing it as a cash cow. And they use this thing called the Pareto rule or the 80-20 rule. And it states that in businesses, 80% of the profit comes from 20% of the consumers. They know that. So they can see if they open dispensaries and sell fun flavored products and push hard kind of Joe Camel style marketing and allow billboards and even television advertising they're pushing for, which we banned for cigarettes in 1971, right? If they can push all of that stuff, then they can maybe get people to get hooked on the product, on higher potency stuff, and they can make money. Where in other industries, where, you know, for tobacco, right, we have kind of a stigma against smoking cigarettes. We don't view that as acceptable and as healthy as we used to. Marijuana, we're a little bit behind in that way, and it's becoming more acceptable, and people think it's healthy when it really isn't. And so they're just cashing in on that kind of public misperception that the industry has been pushing for decades.
Now, marijuana, of course, Jordan, you and I know, and people know generally, is still technically illegal at the federal level. It's on a federal drug schedule. This prevents, you know, a lot of research. It also prevents banks and credit card companies, and I talked about this yesterday with some local retailers around here, you know, it prevents them from handling transactions here. So here in Connecticut, you probably know it's got to either be a debit card or cash. What do you think? What do you hear in D.C.? What is going to happen? Do you think a year from now, 2, 3, 5 years from now, does that change? Does it become an issue in the 2024 elections? Where does this go?
Yeah, so first, I'd just like to address, firstly, you mentioned something about research. It's a common misperception that you can't research marijuana. The first ever marijuana reform bill passed in the history of the United States and signed into law was a bill that my organization helped write. Mm-hmm. And it was signed into law by President Biden about a month ago. And it eases the research barriers on marijuana.
Oh, okay, good.
Changing its Schedule I status.
Good.
So that's kind of one thing about the research. You don't need to legalize it to research it. And we've just proved it. And about the banking issue, this is another kind of misperception. Banks often work with marijuana businesses. Data just came out in November of 2022. That 784 banks and credit unions across the United States work with cannabis businesses. And those are just the ones that are actually reporting to the government that they're working with them. And they know they can work with them because since 1996, when California legalized medical marijuana, the federal government has had a de facto policy of not going after cannabis businesses.
Okay.
And they actually... The Obama administration even actually said that it was going to be their policy to not pursue any criminal charges against operators in quote unquote legal states. And so, what the goal really here is for what happened in Canada, like I explained with Altria, for them to get into the U.S. business too, because a lack of kind of that legal quote unquote legal banking access, like graced by the federal government, that's the only thing stopping companies like Altria from injecting billions in capital into the U.S. markets. And that's something that we want to prevent.
Final question, Jordan Davidson. If we're talking 5 years from now, you and I, what do you think the marijuana landscape looks like in 5 years or so?
Well, what I'd hope it would look like in 5 years is for more education to kind of be put out there by organizations like mine and like-minded ones about marijuana so that we can have a greater kind of public understanding about the harms of actually using it. Unfortunately, this industry, just like tobacco industry and alcohol industry and pharmaceutical industry, has put out blatant misinformation about the harms and benefits of marijuana. And so I would hope that the public has a greater understanding and can see that the mass commercialization, like is happening in Connecticut right now, isn't a smart move. But the final note that I would tell you, Paul, is that
sure,
in states like Connecticut, you know, it's unlikely to repeal legalization, right? But I would like to see some reforms. Connecticut has a relatively weak potency cap law, 30% THC potency for flower. It's widely accepted in the medical community that anything over 15% is unsafe for your brain, even more unsafe than low THC products. And so I'd like to see kind of more billboard restrictions, advertising restrictions, and a stronger potency cap so that we can bolster public health and safety as much as possible.
Interesting. Jordan Davidson. Jordan, thank you. He's Communications and Legislative Affairs Officer for the group of Smart Approaches to Marijuana. And you want to go to the website, learnaboutsam.org. Jordan, thank you. We appreciate it. Take care. We'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. Take care. All right. There you go, Jordan Davidson. Now, see, you learned something there. I didn't know that. Anything over 15% THC is considered not medically safe. How about that? Speaking of Congress, our next guest represented Florida's 19th congressional district in the U.S. House from 2017 to 2021, two terms there. From 2005 to 2008, he served as the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See and the Vatican. Appointed by then-President George W. Bush, he wrote a book about diplomacy and the Holy See relationship titled The Global Vatican. We've had him on several times on this program. Ambassador Francis Rooney is the guest. Ambassador, good afternoon, sir, again. And how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
And Happy New Year to you. Well, what did you make from your congressional days, Ambassador? What did you make of the 15 rounds of voting we needed to get a House Speaker here? Now, you served in the House. What did you make of all that? And what were you thinking watching this from afar?
Well, I thought it was kind of a circus, really. The Freedom Caucus people have a habit of grandstanding and trying to figure out how to create antipathy to fundraise off of, and they did a pretty good job of that. And I think Kevin gave up a lot, and I think he's going to pay the price for it with the creating the disorder and the lack of discipline that those changes are going to allow. I've been thinking of the old 1960s show Queen for a Day.
Oh, yeah. I used to watch that, yeah. Boy, that's old school, Ambassador. You said Kevin, so you know Kevin McCarthy. What's he like? Because he's pilloried on one side and he's jabbed on the other side. These people are actual individuals that work with one another. What's Kevin McCarthy like?
He's a really good guy. There's nothing wrong with him. He's a decent person. He's not a usually policy-centric person. I don't know that he's real passionate about any particular idea, but he's passionate about the Republican Party and our success, and I respect that.
So when you say somebody's not a real policy person, then does his strength, Mr. Ambassador, come from organizational skills, getting people on the same page? You know, Speaker Boehner once said, I think I watched him on The Tonight Show years ago, and Jay Leno said, what's it like? And I think Speaker Boehner at the time said, it's like herding cats. Was he accurate in that?
Yeah, I mean, to be the speaker, you're a football coach kind of thing, you know, and a team manager at the same time. And Kevin will probably be pretty good at that, but he did give up a little bit of authority in these trade-offs to get the speakership, which could come back to haunt him.
Yeah, I understand what he did and explained that. I guess it was a previous rule that you had to have at least, what, a handful of representatives to challenge a speaker, and did they cut that down? Is that what I read?
They cut it down to one.
Now,
wow. It used to be that for many years, it only required one to call for that. And no one's going to vote for it. It's not going to go anywhere, but it does create a grandstanding opportunity for some of the opponents of Kevin, so to speak.
He has served as the U.S. ambassador to the Vatican from the Holy See, or at the Holy See, from 2005 to 2008. His book is called The Global Vatican. Also, two terms in the House from Florida. Ambassador Francis Rooney continues with us. Mr. Ambassador, you wrote an op-ed here. Three key areas you think that the House has to work on here. You know, put all the garbage aside, full speed ahead. One of them is inflation. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the Fed should have started raising rates around 2011 or something after the 2008 recession was over with. But they didn't. They kept the rates low, and it created some asset bubbles because as the lower rates create higher asset values, and they bought all those bonds. And now we got this situation here where inflation is getting out of control, and the only thing they can do is raise rates, and they need to do it. They need to keep them up. Choke off the inflation before it gets out of hand like it got out of hand in the early 80s.
And that's tough, though, isn't it? Because when that happens, the first thing you hear, and you've seen it, and I've had my stable of economic experts on the show, what happens, you know, people's credit cards tend to go up. So although it's medicine, it does sting a little, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, of course. But you either take a little bit of medicine all along the way, or you take a lot of medicine when it gets really bad.
Second thing you highlight here in this piece, and by the way, folks, it's at the Hill, hill.com, safety and the perception and the reality that Americans don't like what they see in the streets.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a little bit of a pushback from the radical defund the police and let's not have bail and let's let everybody out for minor crimes. And, you know, minor crimes become big crimes. And the anti-incarceration, anti-justice is really bad. And I hope that people will continue to rise up against it.
And your third point here, you say, quote, finally, Congress should return to the principle the political differences stop at America's coastline, unquote. We've all kind of heard that in various ways, shapes, and forms, but what do you mean by that?
Well, most of the country's history, we had a bipartisan foreign policy. Both sides were willing to do whatever was best to protect our country against foreign adversaries. And we seem to have lost a little bit of that. It's become political. I think under Trump, the Secretary of State was quite political. Under Obama, the Secretary of State was quite political. And even under Trump, you know, with Jared Kushner's ridiculous Israel strategies that were totally different than 70 years of settled foreign policy, we need to return to a stable, bipartisan presentation of the United States in the world.
What was your impression or your thoughts regarding, you know, some of the people on the far right in the Republican caucus right now who are, for some reason, I don't get it, pushing back now? And granted, the aid is very expensive. It's not cheap. But the public denunciation or couching it in, well, we don't know where the money is going, about the aid we're giving Ukraine, trying to fend off a ruthless aggressor in Russia. Were you as surprised as I was, Mr. Ambassador, by what the Republicans said on that or not?
Well, no, because I think there's always people, especially in the extreme right wing, that want to use any issue they can as a wedge issue. And even something as dire as fighting off Putin's aggression. We need to stay the course. We need to support the Ukrainians as long as it looks like they're making progress. And we need to hearken back to how we got into this fix in the first place.
Mm.
The Russians took Ossetia and Abkhazia in Georgia under George Bush's time. They took Crimea under Obama's time. And Obama immaturely made a joke about it. So what's Putin supposed to think? And you go from a strong guy like Trump to a weak, old, incoherent guy like Biden. If I was Putin, I'd say this is my time to strike, too.
Yeah, he's got to be licking his chops. Before we let you go, I want to talk a little bit, Mr. Ambassador. You did serve as the U.S. Ambassador to the Holy See, to the Vatican. And I believe some of your tenure, if I'm looking at the years right, overlapped with Pope Benedict the 16th, Cardinal Ratzinger, who just passed away. Did you ever have any encounters with him? What were your thoughts when you saw that he had passed away after stepping down some years ago? I think it was in 2013. What's it like to serve in the Vatican and encounter people like him?
Well, I knew him quite well. I mean, he was my pope. He's the guy that I interfaced with and dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
When President Bush came over and Mrs. Bush, Condi, and all these people, that we would meet with him, and I met with him on a lot of things. He really admired the United States, was knowledgeable about the United States, was very knowledgeable and appreciative of the First Amendment. And in that sense, we had a very willing ally to conduct diplomacy between the United States and him. And it's totally different now with this guy from South America. He is a liberation theologist. He's not particularly interested in the United States, not particularly interested in capitalism. And I don't think he's nearly as effective in global diplomacy as Pope Benedict was.
The pontiff that you dealt with, Benedict the 16th, we often don't know, Mr. Ambassador, about popes. I mean, we see them, we see the pomp, the circumstance, billions of Catholics around the world, and I think it's often lost, and I often say this, you may agree with me, that we talk about world leaders, Vladimir Putin, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Emmanuel Macron, Olaf Scholz. But the papacy is I don't know, maybe as powerful on some levels, if not more, than an elected representative. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've argued strongly that the Holy See's unique soft power, lacking hegemonic ambitions and territorial ambitions and things like that, makes them uniquely powerful, that they could have an influence which is not cluttered by secular or hegemonic interest. And we've seen that happen time and again, where the Holy See can accomplish things that a secular nation can't do. Happened when I was over there with a bunch of British sailors mm-hmm. that the Iranians had picked up. And I went to see the Pope with the British ambassador, and we said, hey, see if you can do something, because we don't seem to be able to solve this thing. And he called him Ahmadinejad and wrote him a letter, and they let him out.
What, just like that, huh? That's, mm-hmm. I like that, Mr. Ambassador. See if you can do something on this. And he did. The guest has been Ambassador Francis Rooney, served two terms in Congress from 2017 to 2021, state of Florida, and he's also an author of the book The Global Vatican, also served from 2005 to 2008 as the U.S. Ambassador to the Holy See. Check out his op-ed at thehill.com. Mr. Ambassador, always good to have you on. Take care, and we will undoubtedly talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Have a nice afternoon.
Appreciate it. There you go. How about that? Former congressman, former ambassador to the Holy See, the Vatican, Francis Rooney. He went to Pope Benedict the 16th. Isn't that great? Listen, we got these people stuck. Can you see what you can do? And he got them out. How about that? Good talk a little spending. Now, you may remember a few days ago, about a week or so ago, the governor said this, and he said, hey, we're doing well money-wise, and let's not go crazy just because, you know, we have, you know, a lot of black ink in the coffers.
Thanks to our collective efforts, the era of Connecticut's permanent fiscal crisis is over. It's over. It's over. It's over as long as we maintain the same fiscal discipline that served us so well over the last 4 years.
Ah, so there's the caveat, boys and girls, and the governor lays it out pretty much, frankly, right there.
It's over as long as we maintain the same fiscal discipline that served us so well over the last 4 years.
So will we do that? And there are rumblings now that what counts under the spending cap may be moved around, and Republican State Senate leader Kevin Kelly is joining us to react to what I guess has come out over the past couple of days regarding maybe a little funny business with the cab. Hey, Kevin, it's Paul. Good afternoon. Happy New Year, and how are you?
Hey, Paul. Happy New Year to you and your listeners. I'm doing well. And in addition to the governor's comments, you also heard my claps supporting that we need to...
Those, yes, I heard your clap there, yeah.
Maintain the fiscal discipline that got us to this solid footing. And just so the listeners understand, those fiscal caps and guardrails were the result of the 2017-2018 bipartisan budget that only occurred because the Republicans and Democrats were tied in the Senate, and we shared power during that legislative session and were able to force the majority to bridle their spending, in this case, cap it, and to get our fiscal house of cards in order. But now that we've gone back to one-party rule, you know, you start to see that the legislative Democrats, obviously the governor sees this issue the same way we do. These caps are working. They're helping. And because they work, by the way, we've reduced our debt service by over $400 million. Mm. That means a savings. That's taken a burden off the taxpayers' back and actually can put more money into the budget and reduce the tax burden if they stay focused and their conduct mirrors that. But what it does is it allows us to stay on this fiscal discipline. Obviously, there's some of my colleagues in the legislature that would like to spend more money rather than adhere to it and give the taxpayers a break.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Kevin. I think Senator Looney and some others are saying, well, okay, we're doing so well now. Maybe, what is it, Kevin? There's a notion of moving some of the fiscal aid that is under the spending cap right now and move that out there because of more commitments to cities and towns. And again, I guess, Kevin, I could be wrong here, but if that municipal aid is moved away from the cap, is the notion there, well, the cap is not as tight as it could be, so we could spend more money. Is that what's going on here?
That's exactly what's going on, Paul. And you know, just to refresh everybody's recollection, it was Governor Malloy that declared Connecticut was in a permanent fiscal crisis. And also to go back in time, you know, back under the O'Neill administration was the last time that Connecticut was flush. And they didn't pay attention to their P's and Q's, and they spent more than they brought in. And as a result, we ended up with the state income tax. Well, it's these policies, bringing those expenditures under the cap that the people, quite frankly, passed in 1991 and that we made and put into law in 2017, that is requiring this. If we start taking things out from the cap, well, that means the cap is useless.
Mm-hmm.
And spending is going to go crazy. And the problem is the majority has a bullseye on the middle class wallet as the solution to every problem. And just for, you know, just as a point of information,
sure,
let's be clear. Like, everybody, Republicans and Democrats, campaigned last election, November, on cutting taxes. We said we had a $1.2 billion cut. They said they had a $600 million cut, the largest in the state's history. Well, last week, they've imposed a $100 million tax on the delivery of goods and services in the state of Connecticut, which means our groceries are going to go up. Also this month, they're phasing out that quarter relief on a gallon of gas. So gas is going to become 25 cents more by April because the Democrats have imposed these taxes. And this is coming at a time when we have an operational surplus where we're taking in like 17 more over collection of taxes on a daily basis. That gas tax cut that we had a quarter was only $1 million. So it pales in comparison to what, you know, the amount of revenue that's over collected. And I just can't believe that there are people in the majority that actually think we're undertaxed.
And the aspect now of the governor, and again, I guess he said it this morning, Kevin, at a meeting of cities and towns, saying, hey, he wants an across the board, or maybe with limits of 75 and 100 grand or 100 grand and 200 grand, he wants an across the board middle class state income tax cuts. Who knows, a percent, half a percent, quarter, whatever, three quarters. Is he going to get the votes for that, do you think, Kevin, out of his caucus? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts on this are both the income tax cut. That's what we proposed last spring as part of our budget adjustment, which was a $1.2 billion tax relief package. It included a 1% cut in the income tax. It also reauthorized these spending caps, the fiscal discipline. And every Democrat in the legislature voted no. Okay, now, so I know where they stand. I know that the Republicans all voted yes. So we, I think, would stand with the governor. We believe that these fiscal caps are working. We also want to see permanent tax relief and permanent not only, being long term, but also broad based. That's what the income tax would do. So, you know, if you have 12 Republicans in the Senate, that means we only need six more Democrats of the 24 to get to 18. And then the lieutenant governor could break that tie to pass something in the Senate. So I'm optimistic. I know we want tax relief. We want fiscal discipline. We want to stay on this course that has worked so well and so favorably for Connecticut families, and I'm hopeful and optimistic that we could get six Democrats to come along with us so that that could happen.
All right, Kevin, thanks. Appreciate it. We'll see what happens down the road. Republican Senate Leader Kevin Kelly, we appreciate it. Kevin, thank you. We'll talk down the road. Appreciate it.
You bet. Take
All
care.
Right, thanks. There you go. So, yeah, that is what is coming up here, folks. So understand what's going on here. The state, part of the reason the state is doing well, and I mention this over and over again, is back 2016, 2017, the state Senate was tied. It was 18-18, and I remember that, and I was astonished that it was tied. In fact, it was really, I don't want to say Republican control, but you had a couple of conservative Democrats, at least fiscally, in that 18-18 tie. So it was kind of really 19-17 or 20-16 for better fiscal control. So when the governor said quite properly that our financial house is in order, it's because it was done with a bipartisan group of people. Now, and in that same cycle, not only was the state Senate tied, the state House, only the gap between Democrats and Republicans was something like 7 seats or 10 seats. But what happened? Those results came during the election of Donald Trump. So in the 2018, the 2020, and the 2022 cycle, people were so upset at Trump and Republicans, they voted against their own fiscal common sense and took it out on the state Republican Party. And so now you're looking at more state spending and possibly higher taxes. Boy, you showed them, didn't you? I got to vote against the Republicans because of Trump. Yeah, but the Republicans in this state, they kind of have nothing to do with Donald Trump. I don't care. You do know that the spending's going to increase again. I don't care. I don't like Trump. Okay. I don't care. All right. And we'll get back to open phones in just a bit. One more fascinating segment for you today. Our next guest is a clinical professor of law at Quinnipiac University. She's also faculty advisor for the School of Law's International Human Rights Society and the Human Trafficking Prevention Project. Today is National Human Trafficking Awareness Day. Frightening that this goes on to a level that a lot of people may not realize. Still in the U.S., still around the world, Professor Sheila Hare is the guest. Hey, Professor, it's Paul at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, great. Thanks.
And I think most people know this, Professor, what is categorized technically as human trafficking?
Well, you know, there's actually a lot of examples, but to simplify it, we tend to think of human trafficking as splitting into two major areas. That is sex trafficking and labor trafficking. And it's the use of force, fraud, or coercion, essentially forcing, compelling somebody to perform sex services for a profit or labor against their will for a profit.
It's frightening, and I see the stories all the time. We talk about it here on the news and my show and all our shows here. It's frightening, Professor, this goes on to the extent it does. In the year 2023, we're supposed to be in such an enlightened country and world, and still this goes on. How is that?
Absolutely. And I share that. And I think, unfortunately, even though we see the numbers and they look incredibly large, I think we've only hit the tip of the iceberg. But I think that people are looking for profit. And what we try to educate people about, my students and I, is the extent to which this is happening right under our noses in Connecticut. We have focused at times on child sex trafficking. And our DCF, Department of Children and Family statistics, suggest that something like 67% of these kids are living with a parent or guardian at the time they're being trafficked, and it's happening in Connecticut. And, you know, I think the piece that a lot of people aren't talking about that we're also seeking to highlight is a labor trafficking piece. People in Connecticut who are essentially hidden in plain sight on our farms, in our restaurants, at nail salons, in factories in Connecticut. I have these clients walking into my clinic, my civil justice clinic, every day seeking assistance. And I hear these stories about how they are being forced to work and are, enduring horrible circumstances and are essentially on labor leave.
Professor, I read where some of the coercion here is with threats of violence, threats of withholding food and shelter. But is it also accurate that some of these threats are, hey, I will out you as an illegal and I will turn you over to immigration? Does that happen too?
I'm so glad you're asking about that, because I think that focuses a little bit more on the labor trafficking, although we see force, fraud, and coercion. Obviously, we need those for both. But absolutely. And one of the things I tell people whom I speak to about this issue is, you know, as a mother, can you imagine if you were undocumented in this country and you were lured into these circumstances and then told by somebody, and this happens to so many of my clients, that, you know, if you speak out or if you say anything, you have no rights in this country, which, by the way, is not true. And what I'll also do is call the police, call ICE, immigration, and I can get you deported. And worse yet, some of these folks, parents, have children who are U.S. citizens. And their biggest fear, and the traffickers know it, is that they might be separated from their children. And I often tell, you know, audiences and my students, sometimes it's hard to imagine yourself, like, why don't these people just leave? But these traffickers are smart. And I give that example to say, you know, if someone threatened me with losing contact with my kids and being separated, you could pretty much get me to do anything without any kind of physical threats, without some of the other types of force, fraud, and coercion that you've described.
Professor Sheila Hare is with us from Quinnipiac University, talking about the observance today of National Human Trafficking Awareness Day, and it's so prevalent now in the news, not just internationally at the border, but locally. And Professor, it is gratifying to see that law enforcement does crack down on this, but it's usually, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's usually not a one or two officer operation. I mean, I know these things are cracked, but the manpower it takes is often very deep and very long, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we've made tremendous gains as advocates working with law enforcement, working with prosecutors, public defenders, the police. And I've talked to departments and at the federal level and the state level where people are just really understanding the issue and are sensitive to the trauma that victims have experienced. But I do think we have a long way to go. I mean, you know, that we want to get prosecutions, and I believe in that. And I think without prosecutions, you know, how are we going to stop this scourge? But I also think that it has to be done in a way that protects the experiences and is sensitive to the experience of traumatized victims who are afraid to come forward, afraid to approach their traffickers, and, you know, just with a sensitivity that sort of encourages them. And so I think we need efforts put into services for these folks so they feel like they're being supported and won't be thrown sort of back into this horrible situation where they may become dependent again on their traffickers. But also, you know, prosecutions that understand how difficult, you know, coming forward and speaking out might be, and put the victim's interest as well as central, in addition to obviously prosecuting these folks. And I just wanted to highlight that, you know, my students and I have Human Trafficking Awareness Week. So we're talking about this today, but we also do programs, and we have programs coming up in February that give you sort of a longer view, a longer attention to this issue. And I encourage you and your viewers to look at that. It's part of our Understanding Human Trafficking series. And we have a lot of great panels that sort of highlight some of these issues, especially, you know, the challenges of law enforcement and working with these cases.
It does take, Professor, does it not? And forgive me for editorializing here a little bit. It does take a certain kind of low-level human depravity to get somebody mixed up in this, doesn't it? I mean, talk about the worst of the worst.
It does. And yet it's interesting, because when we talk about, like, who are the traffickers, you know, that could be a dissertation in and of itself. But I think there's, just like with trafficking generally, there's a lot of misconceptions. I think we first and foremost think of usually a male, somebody who's depraved and horrible. Mm-hmm. And yet, like with sex trafficking, we often talk about how women are involved.
Wow.
And oftentimes, you know, somebody who themselves, this is also hard to get your mind around, who's themselves a horrible victim and has been victimized probably for the longest by the trafficker, becomes part of the operation and can be used to sort of recruit people. And so there's a lot of training that goes on to understand that, you know, there's sometimes It can be a complex situation where you see women involved. And, you know, in the labor context, what's really shocking is to hear about, you know, trusted members of the community back home, family members, friends who sometimes make this connection to the trafficker, either sometimes not knowing what they're putting the person in touch with, hoping that they're providing them with a better life, or kind of knowing that they're giving them to a devilish person who's making all these promises about a better life. You can help your family. You can change your children's lives and give them an education. And then they end up in the United States, you know, sort of in a basement, being sexually abused and working, you know, around the clock for little or no pay.
It can
be complicated.
Yeah, I would think finally, Professor, that people should just kind of keep an eye out, right? If they think maybe even if the trafficker, him or herself, is laying low, or the people being trafficked or are scared, or family members, maybe it's, I'm sure you've seen scenarios where neighbors or bystanders or people kind of thought there just wasn't something right at this address, and maybe those are some of the best people to lean on for tips.
I think so. And, you know, again, I just want to plug, you know, the Awareness Week that's coming up, and my students do trainings. If you need trainings, get in touch with me at Quinnipiac, and we'd love to come to your business or your office or, you know, the hospitals. We do hospitals. We teach hospitals, teachers, lawyers, hotels, hotel workers. But yes, to that point, you know, I think it can be counterintuitive because we say, if you see something, say something. But here's the danger. We also tell people, you do not want to be a vigilante. So first of all, people are afraid, right? If I say something and I'm mistaken, what happens? We say, no, don't hesitate. You're going to call these hotlines and you're going to give the information to the experts, and they're going to make the best decision about how to intervene. And again, do not be a vigilante, because I think people, when they think they see something, may want to jump into the situation. And what that can do is put you, the victim, you know, because if the trafficker finds out, that there can be hell to pay, and the people around you at risk. So we really emphasize, reach out to the National Trafficking Hotline. And if it's a child, you know, DCF has a hotline where they will take the information and respond in an appropriate manner. So absolutely, don't be a vigilante, but by all means, if you see something suspicious, you know, call those numbers.
Professor Sheila Hare, clinical professor of law at Quinnipiac University, on the observance of National Human Trafficking Awareness Day and Week. Professor, thank you. It's been fascinating. We appreciate it. Good luck in the future, and we'll be in touch.
Well, thank you, and we hope to see everyone at our Awareness Week coming up in February. Thanks so much for your time.
Appreciate it. There you go, Professor Sheila Hare. Man, human trafficking, 2023, and that stuff still goes on. This whole George Santos thing is fascinating. This guy's a complete and utter fraud. I mean, he lied about everything, his lineage, his mother, where he worked, where he went to school, whatever. And the guy still got elected to Congress. Now, and again, I've talked in the past few days, couple of weeks about this. I can't understand how not one decent journalistic outfit in and around Nassau County on Long Island or in New York, you know, clued into this guy. Now, some people did, but nobody paid attention. So the guy wins. He campaigns as some sort of American success story. He went to this school. He went to that school. He's got this lineage. His mother's parents emigrated from here. He worked here. He came up through the ranks here. It's all a bunch of crap. At least the stuff that's been publicized here. And he admitted it. Yet he's not going anywhere. And I got to tell you something. As a conservative, as a registered member of the Republican Party, shame on the Republicans in Washington for swearing this guy in. I mean, shame on you. Now, a lot of people said, well, there's nothing they could do. He was elected. Okay, well, thankfully, there is at least one Republican in Washington who's got a little class. Congressman Anthony D'Esposito, one of Santos's fellow GOP congressmen from New York, said George Santos does not have the ability to serve here in the House of Representatives and should resign. Amen. Somebody's got to say it. Now, some local folks in Nassau County, and hello to Nassau and Suffolk County for listening across the water. Love to hear from you on this at 203-333-9422-333-WICC. You know, some local GOP people in New York are saying, you got to resign. And I understand what people are saying. Well, we would have voted Republican anyway. We don't like what this guy did. But we wanted to vote GOP and we elected him. Had we known, maybe we would have done something, different. But my God, you got a guy now in Congress who, despite whatever journalistic outlet it is, they're all pretty much coming to the same conclusion that the guy's a fraud. And only one member of the Republican caucus has come forward and said, this guy has to resign. Now, I know what a lot of you are saying out there, and you can call and tell me anyway, and I'm just going to roll my eyes at you, but I'm encountering this online. Well, the Democrats lie about this, and Joe Biden lies about this. Can we not do that, please? It's called whataboutism. Oh, my God. Nothing drives me crazy like that. How about, and it goes for both sides, too, Republicans and Democrats, right and left, conservatives and liberals. Can you just do something for the common good? Is that so difficult? Honestly, what happened in this country, in these cities, in our state? What happened? Where did we stop doing stuff just for the common good? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And I'm online with somebody the other night and just kind of watching from afar, watching these people react online. Well, every member of Congress lies. No, every member of Congress doesn't lie. Every member of Congress does not lie to the extent that George Santos did. It just doesn't happen that way. This guy did not tell little innocent lies here. He embellished his entire life story. It's all crap. So if a private employer, let me ask you this, please explain this to me. If a private employer found this out, wouldn't they have grounds to fire you? I would. Especially if it's a new hire that I have no idea what he or she is bringing to the table. But nobody, excuse my French here, but nobody in the Republican Party, at least in serious numbers, nobody has the balls to tell this guy to get the hell out. I'm sorry. Listen, I know people in politics can have, you know, a few seedy things in their backgrounds, and they generally come from money, and they try and stretch the tax code. This guy is an absolute fraud. They elected a psychopath. They elected a sociopath. They elected a guy with what seems to me, I'm no clinician here, but it certainly sounds like the Republican part of the Republicans are sitting back and saying, well, hello, this guy's a nutcase. But the problem is, nobody, now they can do something, and let's hope they do this. They have to do something in a parliamentary sense to get rid of this guy, to bounce him from the House. He has to go. The notion that you're allowing a guy who lied through his teeth by every media account, it's just not people on the left, it's people on the right. This guy needs to be bounced from the House. Do something right for a change. I know it's a thin margin in the House, doesn't matter. Do the right thing.